Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Reverend Alethea with Rev Up with Reverend Alethea Blog Talk Radio Show. I am your host and the pastor of the Pavilion of God. We are in daylight savings time, and what a relief to be away from the snow and with a little bit more light in our day. This is Women's History Month, and tonight we'll be playing a rebroadcast of a show from 2014 during Women's History Month. We'll be hearing from Dr. Jeanette Hostin Harris. Dr. Jeanette Hostin Harris, who is a historian, a professor, an activist, and a visionary, and a force of change in her own right. So this is an interesting show. It will be a rebroadcast, but I'm hoping that you'll enjoy the dialogue this evening. And so please listen. If you're a first-time listener, a special welcome to you. I invite you to tune in on a regular basis. Also, you can always listen on demand and easily turn your work time or computer time into an opportunity to rev up, accelerate, and energize your life. This is a Keeping It Real show about life. I minister to the people of God through experience, even up to the higher life of the Spirit. This show is a safe place to talk about everything. Tonight, we won't have callers to call in, but next week, that's what we're looking forward to, an opportunity to have a new show, a new voice to hear from, and an opportunity for dialogue. If you're in the Washington area, I invite you to worship with the Pavilion of God. We have our Sunday worship at 12:30, so that means you can sleep in just a little bit on Sundays. And our address is 6401 Chilham Place, Northwest. 6401 Chilham Place, Northwest. Our vision for our church is a world where Goliaths do not prevail. Can you imagine that? A world where Goliaths don't prevail, at any kind of Goliath, a world where people of God know and trust the promises of God to provide a way of escape through Jesus Christ. We're talking about the Goliaths of poverty, the Goliaths of hunger, the Goliaths of violence, where none of the Goliaths prevail. Our mission is to share the promises of God and the power of God with the people of God. We are a mission possible church. So consider being with us. We have a prayer line on Wednesday mornings. And so that's tomorrow morning. I invite you to call in any Wednesday at 6 a.m. for an opportunity to pray, and 12 noon, an opportunity to pray, or simply to hear us in prayer, which can be uplifting and truly a spiritual experience. The number to dial is 605-475-4333, 605-475-4333. Access code is 213-781, 213-781. So I'm going to just encourage you to email questions to me if you have questions or ideas about show topics. You can always tweet me at Rev Alethea, R-E-V-A-L-E-T-H-E-A, or follow me on Instagram, Rev Alethea, A-L-E-T-H-E-A. Or you can always email me at Rev Alethea at gmail.com. I enjoy the opportunity to hear from you, to stay in dialogue with you. I'm not one that simply wants to talk, but I am more than willing to listen. So I invite you to listen this evening to this dialogue with Celebrate the Women in Your Life. They make history too. Enjoy the show.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another Rev Up with Reverend Alethea Blog Talk Radio Show with your host, Reverend Alethea Smith Withers, pastor of the Pavilion of God in Washington, D.C. Tonight, the Women's History Month spotlight is on Dr. Jeanette Houston Harris. She is a historian and a respected citizen of the District of Columbia. So keep listening. This promises to be an enlightening show. If you are a first-time listener, a special welcome to you. I invite you to tune in on a regular basis and to listen on demand and easily turn your work time into computer time or leisure time into an opportunity to rev up, accelerate, and energize your life. The Rev Up with Reverend Alethea show is a Keeping It Real show about life. I minister to the people of God through all phases of their experience, even up to the higher life of the Spirit. This show is a safe place to talk about everything from pop culture to politics. Let's begin at the beginning. Let us embrace our Alpha and Omega sacred connection through prayer. Open your heart, open your mind as I pray. Almighty and loving God, oh, courage my soul, and let us journey on, for though the night is dark, it won't be very long. Oh, thanks be to God. The morning light appears, and the storm is passing over. Hallelujah. Tonight, oh God, we celebrate Women's History Month, and we lift the importance of the lessons and truth held within the past. Oh God, we thank you for the historians who are appointed and anointed to be your seekers of the truth and purveyors of knowledge. God, so that we might have clear vision as we look back and then be enabled to journey on sure-footedly, Lord, with purpose and vision. Oh, courage my soul, and let us journey on. Hallelujah, hallelujah. This is my prayer. Enable us, God, to rev up, accelerate, and energize our thinking. It is in Jesus' name that I pray. Amen. If you are just joining us, welcome. I am Reverend Alethea, and this is the Rev Up with Reverend Alethea Blog Talk Radio Show. If you'd like to join us with comments or questions, join the dialogue by dialing 347-945-7723. 347-945-7723. You can also give your questions through the blog site, and I'll be happy to share your questions or comments with Dr. Houston Harris. Tonight, I am fortunate to have Dr. Jeanette Houston Harris as my guest. For some, Dr. Jeanette Houston Harris is a family member. For others, she's a friend, a sorority sister, a fellow church member, or a neighbor. She is all of that and more to so many people. Dr. Jeanette Houston Harris is a powerhouse. She is a historian, professor, activist, visionary, and a veritable force of change. While attending Central State in 1960, Dr. Harris's case challenging segregation
Houston versus the state of Louisiana, went to the Louisiana Supreme Court. Dr. Harris's case eventually became a part of a larger court challenge, Garner versus Louisiana, that was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1961. The case was argued and won by future Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall in 1962. Her professional life is laced with numerous accomplishments that reveal her scholarship, character, and determination. We are fortunate to have Dr. Jeanette Holston Harris here with us tonight to tell her own story. Dr. Harris, welcome to the Rev Up with Reverend Alethea Blog Talk Radio Show. It is a delight to have you with us.
And it is certainly my pleasure to join you this evening.
Well, I would like to have the audience envision the two of us is sitting at a kitchen table talking about points of history that many of us might not know about your life, but will ring a bell and engender some understanding for a lot of us. So I am so thankful that you're here, especially during Women's History Month. As a historian, you can tell us all about history, particularly African-American history. However, I'm excited about the fact that you personally have been a part of history in significant ways that can help illuminate the contributions of women and African-American women in particular. The audience might not know, so I'll share with them. You were born in Monroe, Louisiana, and you attended Southern University College. And while you were in school, a significant historical event occurred, and I'm sure you didn't even think of it in that way at that moment. So before we talk about your accomplishments in the District of Columbia, can you take us back to your college days?
Yes.
And I want you to let us know about your involvement as a co-ed in the Civil Rights Movement.
Well, thank you. You know, let me first say that Women's History Month is such an important part of our history. And this year's theme is appropriate because this year's theme is celebrating women of character, courage, and commitment. And as you know,
yes,
many women were very active during the Civil Rights Movement of the 60s and helped in so many ways to bring us to where we are today. Monroe, Louisiana is a rather small town in the northern part of Louisiana, not far from Grambling and Shreveport. I was raised at a time where signs of colored and white was all around. It was a way of life during that time. You were to sit on the back of the bus. You were not to eat at the lunch counter. You could not sit on the orchestra level of the theaters, and you couldn't try clothes on in stores. And that was kind of what you came into as a young child and not really understanding it when you were very young. But I had a daddy who was very active, and he was my inspiration. He looked at things, and he tried to make them better. And that's I'm a product of that environment. When you say that, I can recall back, my civil rights really started before I got to Southern. It started in Monroe back in the 1954 when they had the Brown versus Board of Education decision. At that time, blacks in my hometown could not register nor vote before that. And so my daddy thought when the Brown versus Board of Education decision was decided by the United States Supreme Court, and it stated that separate public schools for blacks and whites were unconstitutional and that racial segregation was a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So that law really paved the way for integration and the civil rights movement. And so when that law was passed, my dad said, we're going to get people to register to vote. We are going.
Oh my gosh, that's powerful.
But I think I was sophomore in high school, just going into my sophomore year. And he went down and found out that in order to register to vote, you had to pass a literacy test. And the literacy test, believe it or not, was the preamble to the U.S. Constitution. And that was,
you know, I guess a lot of people would never imagine that.
Right, they wouldn't. I mean, this is a, the preamble is 53 words. It's "We the people of the United States," you know, in order to form the perfect union. And people who are uneducated couldn't remember all of that. So my dad said, my dad's name was Elion Hostin, and he said, "You have a job to teach these people the preamble to the Constitution. I have a job to transport them to the courthouse so they can recite that, to put their names on the roll, not to vote, just to put their names to validate who they were." And so,
you know, that's a story that could be told by itself, all alone, just alone. That's a powerful story. Our kids in high school would read that in a history book and have no real understanding.
Understanding of, that's right.
Wow, that's amazing.
And my, and I took, we took several people down. I taught so many folks. But I remember most vividly my grandmother, who was of age, and she learned it. And she was so excited about going to put her name down to vote and to register.
I'm sure.
She went to the courthouse. And, you know, when you're there, you're nervous. And you got this man sitting there looking at you as to, as to say, you shouldn't be in the first place, okay? And she recited the preamble to the Constitution and missed one word. And he made her come back the next day. And she came back.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, with more commitment and courage and passed and said it and passed and was able to put her name on the list to register to vote. So those
wow,
are the kind of
powerful.
Things that our young people don't have any idea of. Because of those, I mean, we stood on the shoulders of people before us and the next generation, and we go move on. And so that was during my sophomore year, and we did a lot of things like that. We opened up the first library for blacks, the first swimming pool for blacks. We didn't have any of those things, but my daddy was instrumental in doing that, and so I was one of those who had to work all of those things. And I better not ask, do I get paid, okay?
Right.
That was a service I had to give as a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And if I say I get paid, my daddy said, "I'm feeding you. I'm taking care of you. So there's no payment in this. This is what you have to do." So you learn service and commitment at a very early age, and it kind of stays with you almost the rest of your life. So after high school, I was so excited. You know, you're graduating from high school. You're going off to college. This is a milestone. You're grown. You're on your own. You know, you're out of your mama's house. So I was excited to go to Southern University in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And, you know, that was never a question as to whether I was going to college. My dad had already decided that long time ago. He decided where I was going and all of that. So it wasn't a discussion. You know what I'm saying? You passed the
code,
you were ready to go. Yeah.
And so proud
University,
to go.
Yeah, and Southern University was a big university back in those days. You had about 10,000 students, a beautiful campus, and just the kind of place that you love to go because everybody was like family. You know, it was that sense of family. So we all had a sense of pride and appreciation of who we were. And I became involved in a lot of things on campus because I was involved in a lot of things in my little hometown. You know, I was the captain of the first girls drill team, and I was on the yearbook staff, and I started the first black chapter of Gamma Sigma Sigma, which was a service sorority. Although we haven't gotten credit for being the first yet, but I'm working on that.
I'm sure you are.
But during my senior year, you know, I was getting ready to graduate. I was all excited about the fact that this was going to be the end of this college career and the beginning of a new career. And the news flashed across the radio that the students at North Carolina A&T were sitting in a restaurant. And that this incident was testing the laws in North Carolina.
Now, what year is this again?
This is February 1960.
Okay.
And so one of the guys who was the president of our senior class called some of the leaders together on campus. It was a few of us to come together and talk about what should we do to support the students at North Carolina. So many ideas came up, many, many ideas. And I said, listen, whatever we do, keep it secret if it's going to be successful. If you tell anybody but us at the time is ready to do whatever it is, we won't be successful, you know. So we came up with three or four ideas. and left them with the president of my senior class. And then he decided one day in March. It was almost a month later, March 28, 1960. He came and touched us on the shoulder and said, come with me. Well, we knew that meant that we were going to do something, to participate in something. We had no problems with it. I said to my roommate, I was walking across campus, I said, you just need to call my mom and let her know I'll be okay. Whatever it is, I'll be okay. Don't get excited. Well, mm-hmm. that was futile because we all got in a car and went to Baton Rouge to a five and dime called S.H. Kress.
I remember.
Like F.W. Woolsworth, you know, five and dime.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a place where you could go in and shop. It was a place that you could order your food at the lunch counter, but you had to go to the corner, and back in the back of the corner of the store where there was a round table, a tall round table, and a curtain. And that's where you ate your food. You stood up back there and ate. You could not eat at the counter. So we decided we were going to shop first because we were customers, and then we were going to go and sit at the lunch counter and order something.
Oh, my goodness.
So we all sat at the lunch counter. We all ordered something. I ordered tea. And the lady said, we can't serve you. And she was so scared. She said, we really can't serve you. And the whites who were sitting at the counter jumped up and moved back. And they were, you know, like we were had some kind of disease. And she said, we really can't serve you. I said, but we're customers. I want a cup of tea. And she said, oh, if you pay for it here, I'll bring it to you in the back. I said, oh, no, I'm going to sit right here. And we all sat there and ordered our food.
Wow, that's amazing.
And the guy I sat next to, believe it or not, he was one of the managers, and I didn't know that then. I didn't know that till years later. But he didn't say anything. But just all he said one time is that we can't serve you here. And that's all he said. And the people in the back, I guess he instructed them to go call the police. And the police came. And they said, you must get up, you must leave. And we decided we weren't going to leave. And so he came in with the dogs and the billy clubs and told us to get up. And he ushered us out of the store and frisked us down in the street and then put us in the paddy wagon and took us straight to jail. We all were very nervous. Didn't know what to do.
I would imagine. Now, were you a part of NAACP action or this was just an individual student action?
Okay, this was an individual student action, but we had had communication with the local branch of the NAACP, so they knew we were planning to do something, and they were with us the whole time.
Okay.
The local branch was with us the whole time. We were in jail. We were in jail for pretty much the part of the evening, the rest of the evening until late at night. When we came out of jail, the NAACP picked us up, had people to pick us up and bring us to campus, and we came to campus. And there was a rally by 2,000 students that come out to support us, the rally on campus. And we spoke to them, told them why we were doing what we did and what it meant to us as black Americans. And then we all went in the late night to our rooms. And then it's interesting because we were all kind of tired. Because let me say this, we were in jail with real criminals. We weren't in a special cell for any young college students.
Exactly.
We were in jail with real criminals who told us about what they had done, their escapades, but they weren't negative toward us, but they told us about all the things that they had done. And I learned at that moment that I will never be a bad girl because I was never going back to jail.
Because I want to share with the audience, I had numerous times to when I did similar kinds of things in Long Island, New York. But when it came to being arrested, I didn't have as much courage as you did to even be arrested the first time. Because that takes, for those who are doing these kinds of action, it takes not only personal resolve, it takes courage.
It does. Because they fingerprint you, they take a mugshot, they take you mm-hmm. to your cell, they close that door and you know you're in there with four or five other women, not mm-hmm. just you by yourself. And that, you know, your little bed had an army blanket on it, no sheets, no pillowcases. And in Louisiana in March, it was like 110 degrees. It was hot.
And goodness.
The jail cell was unbelievable. There was a toilet in the middle of the floor. There was a shower with no curtain on it. And you had to use the restroom and take a shower before you go to bed. And we swore we wouldn't go into bed. We were afraid to go to bed. And they brought they did bring us a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and some juice to eat. But we were out before we had to go to bed.
Oh, my goodness.
But it was
now,
really...
Now, were you able to talk with your mother or father? Did you make a call? Or I guess someone else made a call for you, though.
I don't know, but we were not able to make a call. They didn't let us make a call. But it was all on the TV and radio and everywhere. In fact, the funny side of it is that my mother was home watching TV, watching her daytime stories and ironing. And she said the flash came on TV, flash. Students in Baton Rouge, and she said, "Oh my God!" And she looked up, and they were putting me in a paddy wagon, and she just called my dad and said, "Go to Baton Rouge right now and get that girl. Go get her." But they wanted us to come out of jail, the two girls. It was four guys and two girls, but we wouldn't come out until everybody was released. We just wouldn't come out, and so we stayed until everybody was released. So. Flashing forward, when we went to campus after the rally, we all went to our dormitory rooms, and my mother's friend worked on the switchboard, and she heard the president call the security guard and said, I have train tickets for them, pack their things up and put them on the train late tonight and get them off campus. That was a word he had been given by the governor. The governor was Earl K. Long for that time. If you remember the Long brothers, Earl K. Long, Huey P. Long, they were awful. They were really against black Americans all the way. And, in fact, Governor Long said, send them back to Africa. That's where they need to go. He also issued an edict that we could not go to any state-supported school in Louisiana, which means and he told the president to expel us. So once we were expelled... we couldn't go to any state-supported school in Louisiana, which made it difficult for us to finish our education in Louisiana.
Oh, my goodness. That's remarkable. You know, I don't think I knew about so many stories, but not about the governor requiring that you leave the state and not be at a state-supported school. That is just something that is almost unimaginable today.
It is. And as I look, I told my husband, as I look back now, because he violated the Constitution, we probably could have sued him, the state.
Absolutely.
And we did not, but we were so busy trying to get ready to go. We went to court after court case, after court trials in Louisiana. They seemed like every 2 weeks they would force us to come back to court. And we'd sit there, and they'd ask a few questions, and the lawyers would argue those and defend those few questions, and then they'd tell us to leave. It was just a way of causing us a little bit more pain than we had already been accustomed to.
My goodness.
Although the president of Southern was black, he was forced by the governor to do certain things that his budget would probably be slashed, you know.
His hands were tied. Absolutely. That is a remarkable story. So now when did your case become a part of a larger case?
Okay, the case, our case was the first case, let me say this, in Louisiana, and it was named for me, Houston versus State of Louisiana. And then several days later, a week later, two other cases evolved in Baton Rouge, and one was a Sitman drugstore, and one was a Greyhound bus station. They test the laws on this drugstore and the Greyhound bus station. What happened with those other two cases, they had not tied themselves into the NAACP or some group to support them as we had done.
Okay.
So they had a little bit more difficult. They stayed in jail a long time because they didn't have the support before they
the resources.
All of this. Yeah. So I was sorry about that because I think that was a very turning point for some of them because they didn't get to go to some of the colleges like we did. A lot of the colleges were afraid to accept us. They were not sure what would happen. Charles Wesley, Dr. Charles Harris Wesley, president of Central State University in Wilberforce, Ohio, invited not only our sit-in group, but a sit-in group from Arkansas, from Tennessee. He invited several other groups to come to Central State and he gave us partial scholarships. And then the Rothberg Foundation out of New York gave us the rest of the monies to go to college, to finish our degrees.
Oh, that's phenomenal. Wow. I mean, I've read a little bit about this, but this that was just the bare bones. And to have
right,
you describe
right.
it like this is just nothing short of phenomenal. I mean, it's a reminder of the wealth of history that resides within so many parts of our community. And we do
mm-hmm.
need to have a forum and for us to have an opportunity to share our stories, because these kinds of stories we can't lose, because
right.
they continue to instruct us about so much of not only what has happened, but what, in fact, we can still do today. And certainly it will be done in different ways, or maybe even in the same ways, but it helps us also to honor institutions like the NAACP and other
right.
institutions that opened the door and protected so many people. We think of these large battles, but they were made up of individuals like you. And many of whom have been able, because of those actions, to go on and do wonderful things with their lives and for the community. That is phenomenal.
Right.
So now, did you ever, well, I guess at that point, did you talk with Thurgood Marshall at any point when it became joined with the Garner versus Louisiana?
No, we only talked through the local attorney, who was Johnny Jones
okay.
from Baton Rouge. Oh. He was kind of our spokesperson with the NAACP to be sure, because to be sure everything was on track.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had a lot of meetings with them, with the NAACP, the local NAACP, but we had to meet at night in people's
mm-hmm.
basement. We didn't even know who they were. They didn't want us to know who they were. And we were not seen during the day much because they were not sure what would happen to us. And so it was kind of a scary moment for us.
Mm-hmm.
But even beyond us, our families endured a lot. We had some
yes,
of the persons who were in the city and whose parents lost jobs.
Mm-hmm.
One person's aunt was beaten. They went through all kinds of stuff. My father was put in jail on trumped-up charges, and he was in jail for maybe a couple of months, you know. And, I mean,
oh,
all
my goodness.
Kind of things happened. So my family actually had to leave Louisiana. My dad owned a shoe store. He owned an insurance company. He had to get rid of everything. They rented the house out, and they packed up and came to Washington, D.C., where I was. Because I couldn't go back home after I finished Central State, because they were afraid
okay.
of things that happened to us. So the only cousin I had who was had left anywhere in the South was in Washington, D.C. So I ended
mm-hmm.
up leaving Central State and coming to Washington, D.C. So that's really how I came here.
Well, that was my question. I was going to ask how you came here. Now I know how you came
yeah.
here. But as a part of this story, let people know. It's a wonderful kind of ending to the story of about how you ended up getting your degree, an honorary degree, from your college. You want to tell them when that happened?
Yes, 44 years later. After I had gotten my bachelor's, my master's, and my PhD in history, the university
uh-huh.
decided to have us all back in 2004 and give us our undergrad degrees, which we never got.
Wow. Praise God. What an incredible history that is. And that's something that informs us and how we, you know, so many of us just don't have a sense of how things will resolve and how the
right.
lessons continue to teach. And this is a story that over 40 years have passed before that particular end of the chapter was completed. And that's
right.
amazing. That
is
absolutely amazing. And again, as you said, you've gone on for your master's, gone on for your PhD, and then you get your honorary degree. That's
right.
amazing.
Undergrad. That's
wow.
right. But, you know,
there's
a lot of interesting little parts to your life after things happen. You know, once I finished Central State and moved to Washington, of course I was looking for a job.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you remember during the 60s, 61, 62, is that on 16th Street in K, there was a building called the Solar Building. where they would put up jobs, post jobs in the federal government on those boards in this building. And we used to go down there every day and look for jobs to see what jobs would be open. And this particular day I went down, because I had a degree in psychology, undergrad degree, and they had all these jobs up for a person with a psychology degree to work for the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps was new then, you know, just opened up. Mm-hmm. And I saw that, and I said, oh, gosh, I'm going to go apply for the Peace Corps job. So I went down to the Peace Corps office. This was about 9:15 in the morning. I went in that building at 9. It's about 9:15, 9:20. So I went to the Peace Corps office to apply. I think they need like 30 or 40 people, persons. So I went down to apply for the job, and the guy said to me, they're all filled. And I said, at 9:15, 9:20 in the morning, how can you fill all those jobs?
Oh, my.
There's nobody in here but me. He said, the jobs are not available. They're all filled. And you're not qualified. I said, I have a degree in psychology. But he had my that form 171 that you used to do then back in the day, form SF-171.
Right.
But on that, they ask you a question, have you ever gone to jail?
Oh, my goodness.
So I had to put that on that federal form that I had gone to jail. And I had to explain why I went to jail. Okay? So he told me that I could not get the job, that it was filled. And I was so furious when I walked out of there. I said, oh, I know he's not telling the truth. I know that's not true. So I went to my cousin's house, and I was sitting there, and I just was angry. So I thought, I'm going to call President Kennedy. I called the White House, and the secretary said, well, he's out of the country. She said, what is the nature of your call? I said, well, I went to look for a job today. I'm a college-trained student with a degree. And because I have a on that form, 171 form, I had to list I've been in jail for the sit-ins, they would not hire me. She said, well, let me get back to you. So my cousin said, you don't do that in Washington. You don't call the president of the United States.
I'm hearing the story. Most people would have been dejected at not getting a job. Instead of you feeling dejected, the first thing is I thought you were going to say, gee, I felt so sad or depressed. No, you felt angry, and then the next sentence you said you called the White House. And so I want the audience to hear that Dr. Harris called the White House and complained about not receiving a job because she had been acted as a really powerful citizen, and then wanted to call back. This is remarkable.
And so
how did that finally resolve?
Well,
that is so funny.
The next 2 days she called me back and said, I made an appointment. You need to come down and talk to Attorney Robert F. Kennedy. I said, really? She said, yes. And this is the address. You need to be there at 10 o'clock. Well, I was living in Southeast then. I didn't know where to go, how to get there. So I started out early in the morning. So I went down to the Attorney General's office. And I was sitting there, and the lady said, yes, you have an appointment. And I'm sitting there shaking, saying, what is he going to say? So his assistant came out first. And he said, are you Miss Halston? I said, yes. He said, come with me. He took me to a conference room where they had a table like 6 foot long, beautiful mahogany table. And on that table sat one folder. And I looked at that folder. I kept looking at that folder. So I asked him, I said, is that folder about me? He said, yes, it is. From the day you were born.
Oh, my goodness.
I almost died. I was so nervous. I was just no good after that. I said, oh, my God, what did I do? Because I know in my hometown, they had driven me to the jailhouse several times for not sitting in the back of the bus. And I kept saying, oh, God, do they have all of that stuff that
I'm sure they did.
And they had all of it. And so Robert Kennedy came out and met me. And he said, my assistant has indicated to me that you are having a problem getting a job, and it's because you were a sit-in student. And I've instructed my assistant to follow it up and be sure that you are employed. And he left. And the assistant called down to the office, Peace Corps office, and asked him, were there any jobs for degrees in psychology? And they said, oh, yes, we have plenty of them. We just start interviewing. And he hung up the phone, and he gave me his card. He said, you go down there to that job, and you tell them that if they don't give you that job, you call me at this man's desk. I said,
isn't
yes, sir.
That amazing?
So I went back down to the Peace Corps office, and the guy said, didn't I tell you the other day that there were no jobs and we had filled them all? I said, you told me that, sir. But then Attorney Robert Kennedy said you had jobs, and I was qualified for that job. So I'm here to tell you that I'm here to apply for that job again. I said, I'm told if you don't give me this job, that I'm to show you this card and call this office from your phone. And he he ran to the back. He was red as a beet. He ran to the back and stayed forever. It looked like to me it was forever. It wasn't forever, but, you know, when you're nervous, it seems like it's forever.
Yes.
And I waited, I waited, I waited, I waited, and he finally came back and said, listen, we can probably offer you this job, but it's temporary. It's not permanent. I said, I'll determine that. And that's how I got my job. My first job was with the Peace Corps, and I loved it.
Wow, that is so amazing. I want you to know I have several callers that have called in. They're not asking questions. And someone on our blog has said, bravo. And I can imagine that the listeners are just so impressed with that, because these are the things that we read about, we see in movies that are from that period in time. But there's still, you know, the sense of who are the people that these things happen to. These people that those things happen to are people that have moved from the South, that are members of the communities in Washington, D.C., and throughout this nation. Things like that happen. And, of course, when you hear these kind of unbelievable stories today of things happening, these things do happen still today. And it takes that kind of temerity, courage, and real personal conviction. And I'm sure you'd agree with that. It's not just being prepared, but being convicted in who you are and what your rights are, and being able to stand up for yourself, and sometimes even have to partner with someone else who can stand up with you.
That's right. And, you know, there's another ending to that little story, is that years after all of that, and I was married and had children, my children went to Potomac School in McLean, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And my son became real close friends with Maxwell Kennedy, Robert Kennedy's son. And my daughter became friends, and they'd visit each other's houses, and Max would come to our house, and Riley, my son, would go over there and spend the weekend. So one day I went to pick him up over at Robert Kennedy's house.
That is amazing.
Miss Kennedy and I were sitting around the pool. And I said to her, I said, I have a story to share with you that I'm sure you have no idea. And I told her about it. And she was just so elated. And then years later, I saw her again, and she said, I want you to write that story up and put it in the library when I get the library.
Absolutely.
Never did. I should. And I didn't do it. And it's my fault. I still should do it.
Oh, absolutely.
But anyway, and I thought that was a good ending to it, because our kids became friends and went to school together. And so that's, I learned a lot about them as a result of that, even after that.
And it's because of your work and others like you that your children were able to go to school there. And so many things changed because of being a part of a force that was moving through this nation. And we have to remember that our individual action makes a lot of difference. And I think so frequently today we will feel as if, you know, it's just me, what can I do, and why should I speak this, why should I discuss this or fight for this one thing or the other, and or even educate or share a story with someone. The reason that we do is because we are part of history, and it's very hard for people to see their importance. And nor did you actually see the full importance of your work in the moment. It is in retrospect that you're able to have the full power of that be conveyed to you. Absolutely. If you want to call in, I just want to invite the audience to know if they want to. I want to invite people, if they want to call in, please call in at 347-945-7723. If you're in the alternative, please post your comments on the blog site, and I will be happy to share your questions or comments with our guests this evening. But go ahead, please, Dr. Harris.
Yes, you know, it's amazing. I teach a course, African-American history course, at Bowie State University. And I tell my students all the time, I said, we've passed the torch to you. You have to be ready to take the torch and move forward. And you must stand up for what you believe. And I gave them a story that happened during Black History Month. I won't call my minister's name or my church. But we were in church.
Oh, well, you want to share, well, at least.
No.
Yeah, you go to
singing.
A wonderful church.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful church. Let me just say this. The choir was singing, and the minister said, they're going to sing the Negro National Anthem, but you don't have to stand up when it's sung as a, I thought he said anthem or whatever he was singing. I don't know what he was saying. And so it started playing, and everybody sat there. And I stood. I was the only one in the whole church that stood. And
mm-hmm.
I said, you always stand when the Negro National Anthem is played.
Absolutely.
I don't care. You always stand. And so I stood. I was the only one, and a visitor who sat behind me, eventually he stood. I could hear him standing. And for a while, I was the only one standing. I said to my students, you have to stand for what you really believe. I believe that whenever that is, that's why I'm teaching you now by James Weldon Johnson. I said, whenever you stand, whenever the National Negro National Anthem is sung, you stand. I don't care where you are. You certainly don't
mm-hmm.
sit down when America is played, when the
mm-hmm.
you know the national anthem is played, the U.S. national anthem is played. You don't sit down; you stand.
Absolutely, and there's such a history with the national anthem.
Yes,
absolutely, tremendous history, and to know that it represents the freedom that Americans fought for in terms of the American national anthem, but for us, it also represents a tremendous amount of pain and suffering and endurance and vision and hope.
Right.
And so not to
James
stand
Weldon
is
Johnson
to negate
that. James Weldon Johnson wrote that in that song, right? James Weldon Johnson was very active with Du Bois in the NAACP. So he fought for a lot of things during that period. So the song is kind of a recreation of the pain and suffering that we had during that period that he was able to pin in that song.
Absolutely. And we need to acknowledge it. And it's so difficult sometimes when you're at, you know, we're seduced by the material, access to material means today. And we easily forget. And actually, sometimes not only forget the things of the past, we don't recognize how much needs to be fought for today.
Right.
And so we will lose sight of it. You know, where we have truly been seduced by materialism and often things that aren't that critical and that important—not land, but clothes and other things, other luxuries many African Americans have who don't actually have the education, they don't have the good employment, they don't have the property, and we forget that these other issues are things that we must continue to fight for, not just for ourselves today, but for our children and our grandchildren. Yeah, such a critical understanding. And so I know you were at the Peace Corps, and then you had opportunity to teach in elementary school in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
What are the differences, or are there maybe two or three differences you might cite between the schools when you were teaching in 64, which I guess 64 to 1970, and today? Do you see any stark differences or things that you might comment on concern for public education?
Well, I thought, looking at what happens today and the young people today and what happened then, I think then we had more control over the children. We demanded more respect. We stressed morality along
mm-hmm.
with teaching and respect of adults and respect of each other. Somewhere today we've lost that. Then when I was teaching, if the parents didn't do it, the teachers gave it to the children.
Absolutely.
We were like counselors and teachers. And I was like all of that. I fed the children. I counseled them. I took them home. I did this, did that. You were everything rolled into one teacher. Nowadays, they don't have that kind of relationship. The teacher teaches. I mean, in some schools, they still do it. In some areas, teachers still play that multiple role.
Mm-hmm.
But in some areas, it's not. And so,
mm-hmm.
and the parents are not always teaching the children.
Mm-hmm.
And the children, I teach in a college where I have to tell my students, you can't come in here with your pants hanging down. I don't want to see your undershorts. You can't come to my class. You can't wear a hat on in my class. you can't chew gum in my class.
Mm-hmm.
I have to tell them that as young adults. I shouldn't have to tell them that. You know what I'm saying?
No, absolutely not. But the sad thing, the sad thing is, what if you weren't telling them? And in many cases, the professor or the teacher isn't telling them. And they're not hearing it at home, and they're not hearing it from the professor or the teacher.
Well, they don't get it.
Yeah, they don't.
They don't get it. I tell you, this is a strange thing to say, but when I was teaching at Federal City College, I was also teaching at Lorton Prison in Lorton, Virginia.
Mm.
I taught there for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed my students at Lorton because they were, not only were they confined, but they were forced to study. They were forced to think. They were forced to use their brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some
of
the best students in that prison. In fact, two or three of them now I keep in contact with. We still have relationships.
How remarkable.
We still have relationships.
That is remarkable. Well,
so,
see, you have a lot of books to write.
I know. My children get so angry with me. They say, "Are you writing, Mama? Are you writing?" I said, "Yes, I'm writing."
Oh, my goodness.
So I
that
just think that
true.
Today is a different, it's the relationship between a young person and the parent. And it's what the parent expects of the children. You know, when we were coming up, it wasn't, you weren't asked to go to Sunday school or church. You went. That was a way of life for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And you learned a lot from everybody else besides your mother.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And now
yes.
the neighborhood doesn't really teach the children. If the parent doesn't give it to the children don't get it.
That's true.
Now, in some tight communities, they are a little bit different, but it's not many of those left.
And I think we have some tight communities, and then we have some families that have these incredible structures and some church communities that set up order for the children so that they truly understand that they're a part of a community and they have a sense of responsibility within that community. And that if you're able to take ownership of a community when you're younger, you hold yourself accountable because you know the community is holding you accountable. And that doesn't happen as easily today. You know, when I think about that, I heard a speech, a part of a speech that you gave for the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. And you talked about the organization focusing on history but not on life. And that struck me as so powerful and so important because we have to figure out not only how to be accountable with understanding our history, but being able to honor African-American life.
Right, right.
And so would you share with the audience about the Association for the Study of African-American Life and History and your role with that organization?
Okay.
Such a powerful one. It's a powerful organization, and you had a wonderful, wonderful role and offered a great legacy for the organization.
Well, I tried to. When I left Central State, I graduated and moved to Washington. Several years later, the president of Central State, Dr. Charles Wesley, retired. I think it was 65. And he moved to Washington where he had a home here because he had taught at Howard many years before. And he moved here, and I saw him one day because he moved here. And let me go back to that. He became the executive director of the association. And for the study of African-American life and history. That was his job. And he was working out of College of Wilson's home on 9th Street.
Oh, my goodness.
And I saw him at a meeting, and he asked me, what was I doing? I said, I was teaching elementary school. And he said, why don't you come down and visit me? And so I went down to visit him one day, and he said, would you like to work here? And I said, well, I'm teaching now. He said, well, you have to leave your teaching job. I said, well, how much money do you have? He said, we don't have much money. We have a Ford Foundation grant, and I could pay you with some of that, but that's all I have. And so I came home and said to my husband, I said, you know, Dr. Wesley is he's executive director of the association, the College of Wilson funded, and he wants me to come work with him on a Ford Foundation grant. I said, what do you think? I said, I'm teaching, so I got, you know, I'm teaching, I'm making pretty good money, and I got health insurance and all of that. And mm-hmm. so he said, well, what do you want to do? I said, that might be fun. That might be different. So my friend said, you're crazy. You're giving up a permanent teaching job with all the benefits to go work on a grant, and you don't get anything for it. I said, well, that's probably true. But I think I'm going to resign and go work with the association. I resigned my teaching job and went to work
goodness.
As Dr. West's assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, I'm going to let you be the assistant editor of the Negro History Bulletin, which was the bulletin College of West had established for teachers. Teaching teachers how to teach and how to teach history. So I worked on that, and I worked there. And then he said one day, after I was there for about a year, he said, you really have a lot to say about everything. Why don't you go back to school? And I said, go back to school for what? He said, to get a PhD. I said, oh, no, I don't have time for that. I have two children and a husband. I said, I don't have time to go back to school. He said, but you need to go back to school. So he badgered me every day. And he even called up to Howard and talked to people. And got me an application and everything. So there I was going back to school to get work on a master's and a PhD in history. And that's how I became involved with the association. I used to follow him around when he was speaking, and I learned how to speak in public and say things about the association. And then years later, much after he passed, I became a board member of the association. I became the national treasurer, and I became the national president of this association.
Yes.
So I had
yes,
moved
and
up
your
the
legacy
ranks and did all of
as,
that, and so, yeah.
Your legacy as national president, I just want to comment on that. You were the second woman to be president of the association, and the
right.
first woman was Mary McLeod Bethune. What
right.
a powerful step that is. I mean, you really followed opened another country.
Real
yes.
legend, right. And the
yes,
first woman historian. And the first woman historian to be president. Because
amazing.
It was a history organization, and all men had been presidents before me.
Yeah, and I was really impressed with the fact that after you, your presidency, there was a woman that followed you, and since then there have been three other women, which means
right.
there's been an opening, if the organization
opening.
Has continued. Yes,
right.
And sometimes we have one woman and it becomes a token position, and then
right.
there aren't
right.
other women who follow, but that
right.
was not the case
that was
for
not
you.
The case.
So
right.
very, very powerful. And can you just help us understand what the association does?
The association was founded by Carter G. Woodson in 1915, and he started the association because blacks could not get their articles published in white publications. And he started the association to help blacks get their works published on African-American history. And then he started Negro History Week in 1926, so that we had this week of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln's birthday where we celebrated. Everybody celebrated black history during that week, called Negro History then. And the association, he also started the journal Negro History, which was a scholarly journal, and then he started, as I mentioned earlier, the Negro History Bulletin for teachers. He wanted teachers, because
mm-hmm.
he taught himself in D.C., college was in the public schools, so he knew what it was to teach and how to teach and what was important. And he loved history. And so the bulletin was a way to get to the teachers' lesson plans on African-American history, how to teach it, things that they ought to know. So the association really laid the foundation for us learning more about our history and our legacy. He also started the Associated Publishers, which published up until maybe 5 years ago. It published works by African-Americans, for and about African-Americans. And the publication was one of the few blacks that had maintained itself over all those years. And so the association still does the same thing. It still helps teachers and education leaders learn more about African American history. It has really fulfilled Carter G. Woodson's mission of having
mm-hmm.
black history recognized throughout the United States and the world. Because I went to Puerto Rico to speak on black history, believe it or not. And so
mm-hmm.
it has really been the foundation of us understanding who we are and why things happened to us in the past, and where we've come from, and where we're going. And
that's wonderful.
It still does that, yeah.
And if you're looking to make a donation to an organization, I'll just put this pitch in right now. I'd encourage you to simply log on to Association for the Study of African American Life and History. It's a wonderful organization to support, and it holds much of the knowledge that we need to have in this country, not just for African Americans, but for all people who are interested in the true history of this country. So it's an important organization to support. And I am just delighted to know of the ways that you have supported the organization over the years. Dr. Harris, can you, for those who, because I have listeners around the country, and who don't know as much about the District of Columbia, but then there are also people who are in the District of Columbia who don't know that much about it. But would you talk about the D.C. Hall of Fame and the Legacy Award? I would really appreciate you sharing something about that.
Okay. I appreciate you asking me about it. But may I just put a footnote in to say that I've been married to a very fine gentleman for 51 years. And I have
yes, and he is delightful to talk to. Yes, please.
I have to put that footnote in because he's been my rock.
Yes.
The Washington, D.C. Hall of Fame, I came up with that idea in 1998. And I thought that I teach history. I taught at the University of the District of Columbia. I taught District of Columbia history. And I learned so much about people having not been from Washington. I learned so much of people in this city who have done so much to build this city, to contribute to the workers of the city. And I said, they never really get recognized by the city. So I started the Washington, D.C. Hall of Fame Society, where we would recognize people for the work that they've done in business, in communication, in cultural arts, in civic, in education, health, law, politics, religion.
And religion.
Sports,
yes.
Religion, that's right. Sports. And science and technology and politics. And I was sure to include religion because that's, you know, the religious leaders have been our rock from the days of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and those are the 11 areas that we recognize outstanding people. And we ask people to please recommend folks to us. There's so many people out there who've done so much that we don't know about. We'd love to know about who they are. And we put together a panel of judges in each of those 11 areas. We don't select. The board does not select. The judges select. And we put all their files before the judges in each one of those areas, and the judges select a person each year who we would recognize and award and give the Legacy Award to. This year we have Michelle Hagan for business. We have Dr. Reverend Cheryl Sanders in religion.
Oh, wonderful.
We have Anthony Williams, former mayor in politics. We have Judge Arthur Burnett in law.
Fantastic.
And we have Wanda Oates in sports. So we have lots of great people this year that we're going to award. We have Deborah Shore, who started a program in the community. And we just have great people that come to us and we don't know them, and they've done so much great work in the city. And so
Absolutely. We're
excited about this. This is our 14th year. I never thought we could last 14 years.
Well, I just think this is a remarkable accomplishment. And if you ever have an opportunity to go to the award ceremony, please, I encourage people to do so. And to know that it's a valuable
it's Sunday,
time
April
to do 20, that.
I'm sorry.
Sunday, April.
Sunday, April 27th.
April 27th. It's a wonderful occasion to attend and to just, again, be reminded of the people who contribute in so many ways to the Washington, D.C. community. You were putting a plug in for your husband, Dr. Rudolph Harris.
Yes.
I think he's a wonderful person. And as she is saying, we celebrate husbands, and also the fact that your marriage is exemplary of the kind of marriages that we want to support and encourage people to know are possible to have, because they seem to be those things that we cannot have. So I want to say a real shout out to your husband and to, you said, your granddaughter as well. So I want to
my two children and my granddaughter. Yes.
Fantastic. Well, shout out to them. And I want to mention one other part of your life, and that is that you are an artist, and there was an art exhibition. And it was blending of butterflies, blossoms, and breezes. And the reason I thought that was important as a historian, we seem to think of people, those who accomplish, and which is important for all of us, no matter what our level of accomplishment might be, that we're in a very narrow way of living. And this is something that broadens an understanding of who you are and it reflects your interests. So how did you get into art?
Well, after I was first married, I'll tell you right quickly, my husband wanted me to be a housewife, and I did not want to be a housewife. I said, I cannot stay home every day. He said, well, find something to do. I said, I don't know what I can find to do. So I started writing poetry, and then I went and bought paints and decided to start painting. And I did pretty good. I exhibited paintings back in the 60s, and somebody bought a painting, and I was so excited this law firm bought this painting. And I was so excited that I had sold a painting. And so I stopped painting because then I went off to school. And my beautician had asked me to paint a vase of flowers for her back in the 60s. And so I forgot about all of that art. I went to school, took on a new life, children, you know, education, all that. And so one day I saw this beautician 25 years later. And I asked her, I said, what did you ever do with that painting? I remember it vaguely, but I don't know. She said, girl, you could get it back because I've changed the color scheme. Come get it. And I went and got it, and I said, oh, how beautiful. And I put it on the wall, and my son came here one day, and he said, oh, I see you bought a new painting. Who painted that? Because they were so young, they didn't know I was a painter in early life. And he saw my name on it. He said, where did you do this? I said, you all were children. He said, why did you stop? This is beautiful. I said, because I was trying to raise you all and everything else and go to school myself, so I didn't have time to do art anymore. He encouraged me to start painting again, and I've been painting again ever since. I just had the second exhibit at Howard University a month ago, and I enjoyed painting. And at the first art exhibit I had, Sam Gilliam, who is a friend of ours, I called Sam and I said, Sam, I'm having an exhibit at Sumner. And I've never had an exhibit before. Can you come? Can I pick you up? Can you come and help me select my painting? I don't know what I'm doing. He said, yeah, pick it up. So I picked up Sam Gilliam, brought him over to my house, and showed him all my paintings. And he selected out the paintings. And he said to me, you are very good. I said, what? He said, you are a true colorist. He said, new artists usually can't blend colors like this. He said, these are great. They're fantastic. So he encouraged me, you know, to continue painting. And that's what I've done. So that's how I got into painting. I'm a self-taught artist.
Yes, and, you know, I want to say to the audience, Dr. Harris wasn't sure she would be able to go for an hour. I think we could have another conversation that could go on for another hour. This has been very enriching and an exciting. I love the dialogues that not only inform but expand the possibilities for our lives. So I want to thank you for being on the Rev Up with Reverend Alethea Blog Talk Radio Show. And the next time that you do something exciting, which I'm sure will be within this year, you always do something exciting, we'll have to stay in touch and invite you to come back and share with our audience some of the your concerns or some of the things that you're doing. Even I will be happy to share with them when you're doing another art show. Because we do need to stay in touch with those who have accomplished so much and are continuing to expand their lives. Thank you so much for being on our show this evening.
And thank you for having me. I have really enjoyed it.
Well, that's wonderful. And we'll definitely stay in touch.
Thank you.
I just can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Harris this evening. It has been such a wonderful time for me, and I hope it's been exciting for you. Tonight's interview has awakened an awareness for me As a child, history was not my subject of interest. However, I discovered later in life that I was actually sensitive to how African Americans and people of color were represented in textbooks that I studied. The accomplishments of African Americans were frequently completely overlooked, or when they were included, the information was not accurate. An incident that stands out for me occurred when I was in high school in Wantagh, Long Island. I was the only African American in the school. I remember that African American history was being taught, and we were focusing on the new nation and slavery. Each time my teacher would say the word slaves, he would look at me. I shared my discomfort with my father, and he gave me an assignment. And as Dr. Harris was saying, many parents did things differently at a certain point. My father gave me an assignment, and he told me the next day I had to go back to the school and teach my class. The next day, because I dare not do as I was instructed, at some point, albeit terrified, I stood up in the midst of the class and recited the information my father had given me about Marcus Garvey, Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth, Mary McLeod Bethune. That ended the study about that part of the curriculum. I'm not sure that my teacher learned a lesson that day, but I did. I learned that accurate history matters. Accurate history that illuminates the lives of African Americans matter not just to African Americans, but to all Americans. I wonder who I'd be today had I had the opportunity to have been instructed by Dr. Jeanette Hostin Harris. What would our country be like if we had more historians like Dr. Harris, more visionaries like Dr. Harris, more people who were willing to sacrifice and fight for civil rights like Dr. Harris. Dr. Harris has not only taught, she has inspired countless students, encouraged friends and neighbors with her knowledge and her passion for justice, and she has helped to honor the contributions of citizens of the District of Columbia. From where I sit, Dr. Jeanette Hostin Harris is a history maker who shines the light on the ways we can all work to make our community and our world a better place. I thank Dr. Hostin Harris for her contributions through the years. Beloved, I'd like to invite you back for next week. My guest will be the Reverend Deborah W. Hafner, president of the Religious Institute in Westport, Connecticut. Reverend Deborah W. Hafner, president of the Religious Institute in Westport, Connecticut. Come back and hear what Dr. Hafner has to say. I invite you to worship with the Pavilion of God at 6401 Chilham Place, Northwest, on Sundays at 12:30. Also, you can join us for a Bible study on Thursday evenings at 6:30 p.m. If you'd like to find out more about the Pavilion of God, please check us out on Facebook, Pavilion of God, a Baptist community. I would like you to call in on our prayer line on Wednesdays at 6 a.m. and 12 noon. And the number for our prayer line is 605-475-4333. 605-475-4333. Access code is 213-781. I thank all those who are listening tonight, those on our Blog Talk chat line who share their comments and celebrated the conversation with Dr. Harris. Remember, the Pavilion of God is a safe place and sacred space. You can come as you are. Beloved, stay in touch. Tweet me at Revelethia. Email me at revelethia@gmail.com. Remember to rev up, accelerate, and energize your life.